Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
Deep with the Sawtooth Mountains of Idaho comes LA Talk Radio's very own The Writer's Block. I am your host with the most, Jim Christina, and I'm looking at my business partner, good friend and co-host, Mr. Richard Polinelli. Good evening there in Fruta, Colorado.
Yeah, frigid Fruta, Colorado.
Frigid Star, Idaho. It is now 33 degrees.
I would go outside and check, but I'd have to check my way to the thermometer. So we'll just say it's cold here right now.
It is cold, yes. This morning it was kind of fun because it was like 18. And poor Bella had to go out and, you know, and it's really easy to find dog poop when it's frozen on the grass. It just shows right. So it's a great trek, you know. But anyway, we have a lot going on tonight. We have I have to say that today Richard and I had our weekly business meeting, and we wanted to do an addendum for our submissions page on Tuscany Bay Books. And the addendum is when you send in it's a submission page, please attach a separate file. Please attach a marketing plan, so we have that available to us as well. We want to make sure that you're absolutely serious about writing this book and selling this book. Because every book that we publish is an investment in us, and it's an investment by us. So we like to make sure that you're serious about doing it. And so far, we haven't had a problem, but we want to add that to our little arsenal. Okay, we have a guest tonight who was on again, off again, and back on again. And we've been bouncing back and forth with this gentleman since, golly, I want to say June, maybe even May. He's a writer. His book that he's we're going to be talking about tonight mostly, he wrote early on in 2000s, and he finally finished it and it was published. And without any further ado, I'm going to bring him in and he can give you a little of his own bio. Please welcome to the Writer's Block, Mr. Evan Balkin. Evan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Before we go any further, did I hear you correctly? You have a dog named Bella, is that right?
I do.
Mm-hmm. I have a dog named Bella as well.
Yeah, she is a golden retriever.
Mine is not a golden retriever. Mine is like 15 different things. I think there's some wildebeest in there. Yeah, that's really cool. Okay, good. My kids will be thrilled to hear that there's another.
Yeah, our dog, actually, her registered name is Brittany's Bella.
Okay.
Named after our Rottweiler. Her name was Brittany.
All right. So that I can't keep up with, I'm honest with you.
Oh, I know. We can't either, so we don't use it. But and we never were contacted by the AKC, so they can't use it either. So anyway, welcome to the show. How about a little bit about yourself? We know that you're a teacher.
I do. I teach writing, primarily screenwriting, television and screenwriting, also creative writing. My full-time gig is at the Community College of Baltimore County, which is a county that wraps around Baltimore City here in Maryland. And I also teach part-time for the Johns Hopkins University, which is also in Baltimore as well. And that's kind of, I do a lot of other things, but that's what I do for a living. So.
Right, right. Now you've got one, two, three, you got five novels under your belt? Five? Is it five?
Novels, three.
Or novels, three, okay.
Three books. Yeah, how many books? I think it's 11.
Okay. Wow, I'm way off. That's what happens when you don't get a bio and you lie about yourself.
Yeah, I should have said 23, but it's actually
we couldn't have called you on it either. You know,
Chief. But Richard and I both read your book, Root That Mountain. First of all, I'd like to know where the title came from, if you wouldn't mind explaining, Lucy.
Yeah, so the title actually comes from this really great old song. That's one of these kind of like American roots songs that was recorded by a bunch of different people. But the most popular version is by a guy named Uncle Dave Makin. And I think he recorded it in the 1920s, I believe. And it sort of works, I think, thematically. But it's one of those things that I don't know. I sort of adore the song, and actually the main character in the book also makes reference to the song, and it sort of worked as a line. And, you know, because it is as old as it is, it's in the public domain, so I could kind of steal it that way too. You know, you got to be careful about those sorts of things, right?
But yeah, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do, which is why the opening music we have is was given to us by the author, by the musician that wrote the piece. And he's about 30, 40-year friend of mine, Rick Gilman. He's a hell of a guitar player. And he wrote that, and then he gave us the copyrights, and he gave us the song with a promise to give us anything we wanted. And he does listen to the show every week just so he can hear us give his pitch. So, Rick, hi, buddy. You're listening. Play good music. Okay. Anyway. Richard and I both read this book. I'd like you to give a brief synopsis of it, if you would, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. What is this book primarily about?
So the conceit here, the plot line, is that we have a young man, an American, whose father is a doctor who winds up going to Sierra Leone to work for Doctors Without Borders. And gets murdered. There's a civil war on there. He winds up getting murdered. So the son feels compelled to go to Sierra Leone to retrieve his father's body. And in the course of doing that, comes to realize that he knows less about his father than he thought he did. So it becomes really a kind of a journey where he's really trying to figure out who his father really was, the contours of their relationship. And then winds up getting pretty heavily involved in the kind of aftermath of the Civil War there, and goes through some pretty harrowing experiences. Manages to survive, comes back to the United States, but he is not done with Sierra Leone, and Sierra Leone is not done with him. Lots of West Africa in this book.
Yeah, there is a lot of West Africa in this book. There is a lot of the Civil War in this book.
Yeah.
You graphically outline what the rebels did and do and probably continue doing to this day. Mm-hmm. it's not a fun read, I have to say. It's very graphic, and it really opens your eyes as to what's going on in that part of the world. And as we talked the other night, I told you then that there really is no real good guys. But there's no real bad guys either. They're just doing what they do, and they've been trained to do.
Yeah.
And it kind of turns out that way.
Yeah. I mean, there's circumstance, you know, and I'm always drawn to characters that I find compelling who are in situations that are just far larger than they are. And you know, you're forced to kind of I don't know, to see where you land, and you make decisions that, you know, given other circumstances, a little more comfort, you probably wouldn't, but you need to do what you need to do sometimes. And in the end, you're right. I mean, that was sort of a difficult element of this book as well, was grappling with characters that I wanted to make them very human, and I'm very aware that we all like to root for people, and that we want our heroes to be, you know, heroic, but they're gonna fall short, as we all do, right? And so I think the trick then becomes, can I get a reader to sympathize with an imperfect protagonist? You know,
right?
That's sort of the difficult trick that I often do, actually, in a lot of my writing. I don't know why I'm so compelled to, you know, so drawn to that, but it's always been a thing with me.
Well, I have to say that about halfway through the book, I started feeling having feelings for the younger of the rebels. They were so confused as what they were what they were doing, yeah, and why they were doing it, and they were following orders but reluctantly. And it was amazing to see the transition between the youngsters as they grew and the youngsters that really didn't want to be where they were.
Yeah.
And I liked that part of the book a lot. It really showed a lot about the children soldiers of West Africa.
Right.
And they certainly are there. So I love your writing. Your writing is phenomenal.
Well, thank you.
You don't overflower anything. I mean, that's obvious, but you really don't. And your descriptions are short, sweet, succinct, and to the point. But they're very, very visual, and we like that.
Good.
And writers that, I mean, we've had writers on here that it's taken them 14 pages to describe a flower, you know, and it's like, nah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I do have to say there's probably, I don't know if it's quite 100, but there may be 100 or more pages on the cutting floor, you know, that, that maybe that one page of a flower description at one point was 7 or 8 or 14. And, you know, you do have to cut and cut. I mean, you mentioned it at the beginning. I mean, this was a strange book for me in the sense that I literally wrote the first words of it, I think, in 2000.
Right.
And as I mentioned, I have 11 other books. I write a lot of screenplays. I do a lot of things. So there was always sort of there. I would go back to it. I wasn't particularly happy with it. I'd go back. I would make changes. And there were parts of it that it felt like, you know, when I first started, I was in my 20s. And it read to me like my 20-year-old, 28-year-old, whatever, writer self, which is very, very different from what I am now. And that a lot of it was, as you say, cutting and cutting and cutting. Because I used to overwrite. Absolutely, I used to overwrite. Yeah. In fact, I still sort of overwrite, if I'm honest with you. But
well, I think we all do. But we were smart enough to go back and cut a lot of our extemporaneous crap out.
Yeah.
You know, to make it as clean as we possibly can.
Right.
So, and with that, let me hang on, Richard. Let's go ahead and take our break. And this is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block, and we will be right back after this very brief word from LA Talk Radio. You ever listen to a radio talk show and think to yourself, I could do that, or I could do that better? Well, now's your opportunity. See, LA Talk Radio has slots available Monday through Sunday, and they're all day. We're looking for hosts to fill those slots. So if you have an idea that you think translate to a radio talk show, go to latalkradio.com, find the link that says Become a Host, click on that link, and before you know it, you will be the host of your very own talk show right here on LA Talk Radio. And you'll be joining the hundreds of hosts that have got their start in radio right here at LA Talk Radio. So you've got nothing to lose and everything to gain. Remember, that's latalkradio.com, how to become a host. Sam Hassan will be happy to walk you through it, and you're going to be proud of what you can do as a host of your very own radio show, LA Talk Radio. And we are back with writer Evan Balkan. It's Balkan as in the mountains in Eastern Europe. And we're talking about his book, Root That Mountain. And if you want to call and talk to Evan, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. And again, that number is 323-203-0815. Okay, Richard, you had a question.
Well, I just want to say, you know, you really caught how that area of the world was then and to some extent still is. I really liked how you introduced us for those who just aren't aware of what's going on there. I got to admit, though, with your main characters, I kind of about midway through was thinking, gee, I hope he puts them all on a plane and the plane crashes, because I couldn't really find anybody that I could connect with as a reader. But, you know, as it goes, you know, you understand this is really Felix's journey through this story. My question to you is, why did you choose this setting for this book?
As I mentioned, I started this thing a couple of decades ago, right? And came back. I will say that this is not a book I would write now. And the thing is, the reason for that is because, well, we are, you know, I don't want to get political, but we are living in a very, very different time. And the reality is, I think a lot of people would feel that this is not my story to tell, right? That this is, in other words, as a white American, I don't get to tell this story. I'm not so sure I agree with that sentiment, but
I disagree with that. I think if you're a writer, your job is to gather the information you need to gather and then tell the story. And as long as you tell the story truthfully and accurately, it doesn't matter what your skin color is or anything or where you came from, as long as you're telling the story accurately. So yeah, I'm like you. I don't agree with that viewpoint at all.
Yeah, I mean, right, and that's obviously, you know, that's a whole different discussion. But that is the sort of moment we are in at the time. But to answer your question, I mean, I do think that, you know, when this was going on, when this civil war was happening in Sierra Leone, I suspect that relatively few people in this part of the world were even aware of it, and it. Not only aware of, because, you know, we are all human beings after all, there is actually a very tangible connection. There was a long moment in time, and I do get into this in the book quite a bit, in which the vast majority of us in this part of the world who bought, or in Europe and other places, who bought diamond rings, right, they were coming from here, and they were coming with hacked off limbs. They were coming with a lot of blood, and they were coming with a lot of pain and hurt. And so it's not, I don't mean to suggest that it was, you know, my goal to educate everybody or to turn everybody off the diamond industry, not that at all, but simply there is a reality to these things in the same way that every one of us who carries a cell phone, it's got elements in it that probably came from the Congo, which carry a lot of misery with it, right? I mean, just the extraction and the war. So I just, you know, it feels necessary to me to be, whether you do anything about it is a different story, but just to be aware. So I found, you know, there was that. Also, it's just, as I mentioned in the beginning, I'm always drawn to characters that are small in the sense that they're just, you know, one individual, one human being among the, whatever it is, 8 billion of us. But are caught up in events much, much larger than they are. And what do you do? You know, you flail, you fight, you try to understand, you try to figure it out. And when you take a character of relative privilege and dump him or her into a situation as brutal and terrible as this one, there's inherent drama right there. Whether you do a good job of capturing or not, it's a different story, but you're already sort of set yourself up, you know, narratively. I'm also very, the writing that I like to read, I'm very big on setting heavy work. I do a lot of travel writing myself. I do a lot of traveling myself. So I'm always interested in other parts of the world anyway. So all of these kind of disparate elements came together to land in West Africa, really, is where.
Had you ever gone there in that area? I mean, not specifically Sierra Leone, but anywhere close?
Close, yes, but not there. Much more stable place in Ghana, which actually does creep up in the book, yeah, a little bit.
Because I was wondering, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, you have a situation where Felix just lands, and he goes to get, I think, something to eat and something to drink. And I'm trying to remember if it was the food or the drink that he had. And a half hour later, his guide is telling him, whatever you do, don't have that. Right. And he's like, well, I already had it. And he goes, well, you're going to get sick. So,
right.
And he does.
Yes. I have had that experience, actually. Okay. Not in this particular place. But yeah, that's, you find out a little too late that you shouldn't have done what you did. Right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's all part of it. Afterward, you know, it's one of those things that afterwards, when you get home and you're telling the story years later, it's usually like the best part of the story. In the moment, it is the absolute horrible worst. But, you know, you survive and you get a good tale out of it. So,
right. You've got a great character, and she makes very short appearance in the book. But she was very rich in character, and that was his mother. And I really liked her because she was the epitome of usury and manipulation. The woman was a master at manipulator. She truly was.
Yeah.
And I liked the way you wrote her, in that we've all known women like that or people like that.
Yeah.
My mother was that way, and I figured, he knows my mother. So.
I would it upset you or surprise you to know that she was the model for that? No, obviously we never.
Oh, actually, I would have believed it. I told you, I said that's my mom.
Yes. Actually, it's funny. So she's another character that, I think on the surface comes off as not particularly likable. I actually have great sympathy for her, however. I find her sort of, her aloofness, her manipulation, whatever it is, to be thoroughly earned. I mean, she loses her husband in this really sort of horrific way.
Right.
And he wasn't particularly honest with her. And then, it looks like she may lose her son the same way, right? I mean, I can kind of get why she acts the way she does. And I do think she's redeemed at the end. I do think that we come to sort of recognize that she is just a deeply wounded person. And so,
right.
And again, I kind of like her, actually.
I didn't dislike her. I really liked her character.
Yeah.
So, it was she was well written.
Thank you.
And in fact, his guide was a well-written part as well, and I like the conversations that they had both on the plane, off the plane, and when they were taken by the rebels and held captive. That poor guy went through hell. Put the gun up next to his head and shoot it off. And that's a warning.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to listen to that warning.
Yeah.
Yep. So, I mean, the whole book was very well done. I really did appreciate reading it, although I don't want to read another one like it for a while.
Yeah, so, I'm kind of there, too.
Let's go back to romance novels or something.
I don't know if I'm going that desperate yet. The character, it's hard to connect to a character. Like you said, you didn't write the heroic, shining beacon on the hill character for the hero. But the way you wrote each character, they fit in the world they were in.
Yes.
And that made that readable. I've read books where a person is in a situation and there's no way in the world they could be doing or acting or be the way they were in that situation. So you matched your characters with the world you put them in. And I think it enhanced our understanding of what, if you leave the United States and you drop into this, it's a massive culture shock.
Yeah.
And I don't think people would know that unless they'd either gone there or read a book like this and understand, this is kind of the way it is.
Yeah, the closest feeling I can get is when I got off the airplane at Tansanut Airport in Saigon in 1969. And they opened the airplane door. And you go to the door and you look out and you're looking at the ladder going down and that heat wave hits you. And it is a whole different world. And you think, holy shit, I am here for a year. And that's the start. But I have to say, you gave us West Africa.
Yeah.
You absolutely virtually gave us West Africa and the Blood Diamond trade, I might say. So I applaud you in your efforts. And Blood That Mountain, it's available. Get it fast because there's only 8 copies available on Amazon right now, and that's it for a while, which we will talk about later. But right now there are 8 copies available, and if you haven't read this book or haven't thought about it, please do look it up and get a copy because it may bother you to read it, but it's a great story, and it's a great book. So please, Evan Balkan and Blood That Mountain, available on Amazon, and a lot of the, I don't know about online booksellers. I didn't look at any of the other ones, but it is available on Amazon with 8 copies left. Okay, Evan, let's talk a little bit about your process. When do you like to write, and where do you like to write?
Well, so I've been very fortunate in that my job, since I teach writing for a living, there is this consistent kind of loop thing that happens, right? Where let me back up. So I this won't surprise you at all, but I'll tell you an anecdote. When I was finishing up, I went to Johns Hopkins for graduate school for writing, and on our very last meeting in our thesis class, the program director, there was probably 12 of us sitting there, and he says, all right, how many of you are still going to be writing regularly 5 years from now? And of course, you know, we're in this program. It's a very good one. It costs a lot of money. You know, there's all this kind, right? So we all raise our hands, every single one of us. And he says, well, you know, here's the bad news about this. And someone, I don't know who it was, but somebody had done a study of like taken like the top five or six, you know, graduate writing programs in the country and looked at graduates 5 years later and see if they were still writing regularly. And he's telling us this, and he said, do you want to know what the percentage of the people were that were still actively engaged in writing, you know, like a little bit every day sort of thing? And it was 20%, one of five. So four of five, you know. And then he says, well, if you think about this, people have families and they have jobs, and a lot of people don't particularly like their jobs. So you think about it, you go off all day long, 8 hours, 9 hours a day, whatever it is, you battle traffic, you get home. I mean, the notion that you're going to sit down and write then is sort of, right, there's just no way that's going to
happen. Yeah, it's not going to happen.
But for me, and because not only do I teach, but I have, you know, I had summers off, I've got a 6 week winter break. Most of my career at this point has been administrative. So I'm usually only teaching one or two classes a semester. I can literally in my office at work, right? And it's part of my job because it's what I teach. So it's not like I'm even being negligent, right? I mean, this is actually part of what I do. So the answer to that is really, it's pretty much every day. And I don't have a problem finding the time. I'm hugely sympathetic to people who can't find the time. I understand it. Mm-hmm. But for me, that's never been terribly difficult. You couple that with the fact that I really am pretty industrious. I'm always working on something. But that is, I think, a function of just sort of general kind of craziness. I have difficulty just sort of moving through the world and engaging with it without immediately thinking story. How does this become something that I can sort of say? And I don't know. I mean, I've really thought quite hard about this. I think, and this is not, I don't know, this doesn't make me sound great, but I think it's really one of these weird things where we all know we're not going to be here forever. You know, how, I don't, what do we do that sort of assures a certain level of immortality, right? Because I think it's back there in the back of the head for all of us. And for some people, they don't care. And that's great. I actually envy that. For others, it's whatever, having children, you know, putting your name for it. For some people, it's scratching your name into a tree or wet cement or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. For me, I'm just sort of hopeful that something exists when I'm gone. and I guess, you know, this isn't to say that I think in 50, 60 years, there's going to be, you know, tons of school children reading my work. I don't think that's necessarily the case. But now, because of the digital age we live in, and because what we're doing right now, there will be a record. It will be there. Mm-hmm. There will be. And right. I mean, maybe, who knows, maybe there'll be some great, great grandkids or whatever. It goes, oh, that, you know, that was kind of cool. That dude.
Right.
I know. Yeah. Right. I mean, right. So that's kind of the motivation.
Right.
But that's not what you asked me, did you? You asked me about process.
Well, that's that works too. You know, you can ask whatever you want. In fact, as far as legacies go, my second son Brian, or Joe, and my daughter Patricia both have full sets of everything I've written, and they're going to keep. They're never going to get rid of them because my daughter says, "Dad, this is your legacy. This is, if nothing else, do I get from you? I want these books."
Yeah. And I brought this point up in a podcast because I was asked. There's a person who runs a blog who was kind of giving me some grief, and they were like, well, how do you respond to that? And I said, my response is, this guy's blog, when he dies, will go away.
Right.
When I die, I look over at the bookshelf that has all the books I've written, all the anthologies I've been in, and those are going to be here as long as books can be sold somewhere.
Right.
So why do I care what he thinks? He's not the person I'm doing this for. I'm doing it for me, and I'm doing it for people who like to read the kind of things I write, and for my kids and my grandkids to look and say, hey, right, that was the old man who did that. Right. So your point to be, you know, toward legacy, I think as writers, we all have that in the back of our head. Whether or not we're going to admit it or not is another issue. But I think we all think that. This is a way that we live on past our time on this planet is what we leave behind in our books.
Right.
Right. Oh, and I mean, honestly, like, how dare us be so presumptuous? But the truth of the matter is, if you don't have an ego, you're not a writer, right? Like the very
exactly,
next,
yeah.
Yeah, like the world needs to hear what I have to say, right? I mean, like, you have to have an ego for that.
And obviously. Right, absolutely. And now we're going to take another real quick break. Don't go away, Evan. And we'll be right back with you. This is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. And right now, we have a brief word from Tuscany Bay Books and Black Dog Publishing.
It was a dark and stormy night when she walked into my office. She had a manuscript, didn't know what to do with it. She'd finished, typed the end and all, but there was so much more she had to do. So I told her about my friends over at Tuscany Bay Books. They do all the editing, the formatting, they put a book cover on it, get the marketing done, they even have a publicist. Can't beat that in this town. So I sent her on her way to TuscanyBayBooks.com. Maybe that's where you should go too. As for me, I'm just going to sit here in my office and watch it rain.
And we're back.
We've got another commercial we're going to debut sometime down the line, I hope. Okay.
All right. I have not. I was going to ask you, Richard, when we record it and speed it up just a little bit. The second
okay,
one
I can do that.
Yeah. It's okay. A great commercial, but just needs a little bit more speed on it. And okay. Right now, listening to LA Talk Radio's very own Writer's Block, and we are in our studio with our writer tonight, Evan Balkin. And if you want to call and talk to Evan, the number here at the studio is 323-203-0815. Boy, I almost screwed that up. 323-203-0815. And we're talking to Evan. We have been talking about his book. And we're now going to be talking about the process and where he likes to write. And he likes to write in his office, apparently. And, of course, he teaches creative writing, so the guy's pretty much got an open book. How many words do you like to do a word count during the day? Or do you have a goal in mind every day?
Not really, if I'm honest. I mean, it'll depend on if it's the summer and I'm not teaching, then yeah, I want to get down at least 1,000 words. But it's also dependent on the thing that I'm working on. So I will sort of toggle in between primarily novels and screenplays. But there was a little kind of a year-long period fairly recently where it was nothing but short stories. So obviously the word count's going to be determined by, you know, what it is. So if it's a screenplay, I want to get at least 10 to 15 pages. But yeah, novel. Yeah. I mean, I'll put it this way. I want, when I lay my head down at night, I want to be able to point to something measurable and say, that's what I did today.
Okay.
If I do that, I can sleep. If I didn't do that, I cannot sleep.
Sure.
I toss and I turn and I berate myself.
And I will say that, like a lot of good writers, Richard does it, I do it, and most of the writers we talk to do it to a degree, is we're going to talk about research. And your research is phenomenal on this last book, or the book that we read. The research was impeccable. And for new writers who are listening, there's one word that you have to be able to learn and have to be able to do, and that is research. If you're writing anything historical, if you don't research it, you're in big trouble because you're never going to be able to finish that book. And I could see that our guest agrees with me. Evan, what do you think?
Oh, yeah. Someone will know.
Absolutely.
Someone will catch you. Yeah, for sure. But, you know, I actually, it's the first novel that I published, the protagonist is a 12-year-old girl. It takes place in the early 50s here in Baltimore. The Baltimore part of the research wasn't terribly difficult. I know the city well, but it does involve integration, school integration, and Korean War. Her father's fighting the Korean War. But the reason I bring that up is that the primary research there, you know, I've never been a female, and I haven't been 12 in a very long time. So getting that right really required. So I'm a soccer fanatic. I coach. I play. I referee. Right. And for many, many years, I coached both of my daughters' soccer teams. And these were, you know, high level travel, very competitive teams. And so I was around, you know, young girls, young women for lots of times. And I'll tell you, I never in a million years would have been able to write that book had it not been for all of that time. You know, we would practice at least 2 to 3 nights a week. We'd be together on weekends. And I would just, you know, just listen to them, watch the way they interacted, see, you know, who they were as people. To me, that's research too. I mean, I needed to be able to capture a particular person that is miles away from who I am, and do it, you know, with some authenticity. And that's, again, it's sort of live research, right? It's not, I'm not getting it in a library, but it's the same. I was just talking to my students about this the other day in class, that it's really a question of just being open to the world, right? I mean, just absorbing everything around you. I'm constantly telling them, take off the headphones, get out of your phone, you know, listen to the way people talk, and, you know, observe, and just sort of be, and to me, that's research too, you know? But you're right. If you're doing the historical stuff, yeah, you better. I always tell it, you know, you, it's one of these things where you know everything and then leave out about 90% of it, right?
Exactly.
I
agree totally. I did a book called Bugles in the Sun about the last 20 days leading up to the Battle of the Little Bighorn, told by the trooper's perspective of the 7th Cavalry. And that book took me over a year to research because I wanted to make sure everything in that book was spot on.
Yeah.
And the other thing,
you were right. They are going to catch you if you're wrong.
Yeah.
And the other thing about research is don't just go on the internet.
Right.
Because just because it's not on the internet doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Right.
I did a book from the fields, and I spent an entire summer at the library at the local college going through microfilm of newspapers, you know, 80, 90 years back.
Right.
To get everything off there that just wasn't on the internet. In fact, I became part of the tour for the new students. They would come through and they would show off the microfilm because none of these kids knew what a microfilm machine was or why you would be sitting in front of it and what are you doing.
Yeah.
So the library person is there and she's like, yes, you search through newspapers and you find your important information and sir, what are you searching for? And I'm like, well, I'm going through old football games for the high school, you know. Big research here, but you know, she goes, and we're off to the audiovisual, and they never included me again after that. But you can't just jump on the internet, right, and do it in a night and move on. If you're right, especially historical, you can't just go with one source. You better go multiple sources and make right sure it all meshes, right, because you will get yelled at if you miss something.
Right.
Well, I think too, you know, if feasible, if you're writing about a particular place, go to that place, even if it's, you know, even if it's, I actually published a biography years ago at the University of New Mexico on a 16th century Basque conquistador. I mean, I was half a millennium late on this guy, right? But he terrorized northern Venezuela, and I was able to secure a research trip there. And there's a shockingly large amount of sort of remnants from his time. But I spoke to local people. But even just the, you know, eating the food, smelling the, you know, what it's like. Now, granted, again, it's hundreds of years later. But if I'm going to write authoritatively about a particular place, if you can get to that place, it makes all the difference in the world. Even Absolutely. Again, even if it never makes it into the book, it's just knowing.
That didn't happen to be Juan de Anate, was it?
No, it was Lope de Aguirre. Sorry.
Okay. Well, you know, living in New Mexico for 4 years, that's the one guy I knew about, but the other one, no. Yeah.
You mentioned something a little while ago that grabbed my attention, and you said, listen to the way people talk.
Yeah.
And which brings us into dialogue. And dialogue is extremely important in a novel, or especially if there's a lot of dialogue. Because you have to make sure that your dialogue is how people talk. They start, they stop, they stammer, they think about it, they go, okay, I can do that. And people have different ways of talking. And to capture that, you have to listen to the way different people talk. And Richard and I both are dialoguists from way back. We love writing dialogue. And the dialogue in your book was very well done, incidentally. There's a lot of dialogue that Richard and I have read that is horrid. It's stilted. It's formal, and nobody talks that way.
Yeah.
You know, but your dialogue is good. And give me a real brief thought about dialogue, because we got to have to move on to another break. But give me your thoughts on dialogue real quick.
Well, I mean, it's, to me, dialogue is characterization, right? I mean, the way in which, I mean, dialogue has to sort of do, and this is the heart of screenwriting as well, is that it has to function on more than one level, right? It can't be expository in the sense that people are not going to talk about things they already know, and they're not going to say, hey, great to see you, Jim. I can't believe we met in, you know, fifth grade, right? We're not going to say that to each other. We know that already, right? But if it advances the story and gives us a better sense of the character at the same time, it's doing the work, right? Instead of simply just filling space. And that's, like, as you say, that's not the way people speak. I mean, even a small thing, people generally don't even use each other's first names unless you're pivoting to something serious. Like if I speak to my friend Mike, who I've known Mike for 30 years, I don't think I ever use his name but recently his mother passed away. And I found myself saying, Michael, I'm really sorry. Suddenly I'm using his name, right? It's a very small thing, but it's just the way in which we interact and speak with each other. And it's really important to listen to people. Tell you the way they speak. Yeah,
it really is. And we're going to take our last break. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you about writer's block. So be thinking about that. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block, and we'll be right back with you after a brief message from Creative Edge Publicity. Okay, you've written a book. Now, how are you going to get your name out there? Well, the folks at Creative Edge Publicity will. That's their job. They aren't going to sell your book. They don't want to sell your book, but they will take your brand from the ground up so you are known in your genre and within the writer's community. They'll do this by using relationships with contacts they've made in TV, radio, podcasts, and publishing to get your name and your brand recognized. Why are you waiting? Contact Creative Edge Publicity today at www.creative-edge.services or email Mickey Mickelson at mickey.creativeedge@gmail.com. Creative Edge, it's your word, it's your work, and it's your brand. Why trust it to anyone else? And we are back for our last brief segment with Mr. Evan Balkin. And, okay, I told you we were going to ask you about writer's block. You were ducking down, so I don't know if you were throwing up saying, oh, my God, I hate this question.
No, I was just ducking out of frame so I could.
You know, we do call our show The Writer's Block for a specific reason. And we ask every writer that's on, have you ever had writer's block? And if you have, how did you get through it? And if you haven't, how do you escape it?
All right. So I'm going to give you probably a very unpopular answer because I suspect that people will listen and go, dude, no way. But truthfully, I don't believe in it. I think you know how you get out of writer's block? You write. It's as simple as that. And as long as you can accept the fact that sometimes you're going to write just absolute crap. Right. I mean, I do it all the time. So in other words, if I'm sitting down and it's just not there, it's not happening. I just continue to write, knowing full well. So here's how I'll look at that and say, okay, there might be one sentence in there that's actually a good sentence. And if that's all I got out of it, so be it. I'll take that and I'll move forward with it. But to sort of look at that and go, I can't write. Well, I mean, you know, the only way you write is you write. Now that said, I do have to say, I have very often been stuck on plot points for trying to figure out exactly where I'm going to go, and I don't know what I'm going to do, and it seems incredibly daunting. I know you've heard this before. I suspect you probably agree with this. I do some of my best writing when I'm walking in the woods, when I'm in the shower, it's like I could be thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it. The best ideas come when I'm not thinking about it. In other words, it's in my head. I'm trying to figure out what I want to do in a particular, you know, story with a particular character. If I don't know the answer to that, I'm taking a long hike in the woods and I'm just losing myself and I'm just not thinking. And I'm telling you, 9 times out of 10, it comes to me without any kind of problem. It's just disengaging, but it's keeping your head active It comes, at least for me. I mean, that's always been just
the... Well, that's a fair answer, because that's not the first time we've gotten that answer.
Okay, good.
You know, in the 7 years we've been on the air, I would probably guess we about a quarter of the time. Would you say, Richard, we get, I don't believe in writers?
Yeah.
You know, writers do, writers don't. It's just depends on where your head is. And I strongly suspect it's what you just said, that you're struggling with a plot point more than struggling with writing.
Yeah.
You know, because I push through on plot points too, and then I go back later and I go, oh, where did that come from? You know,
hey, that's what editing and rewriting is for.
Wrote, you know, we have a guest that's been on a couple of times. Her name is Tosca Lee, and she gave us a point one night. She says the deal is, write drunk, edit sober. We can do that. And then our guest last week had the sign on his wall. In fact, he turned his camera and he goes like that, and there's a big sign on his wall that says, "Write drunk, edit sober." We loved it.
That's funny. Can you write drunk and edit drunk? Does that work?
You probably can, but you won't do a very good job.
Yeah.
I would hate to see that book.
Yeah, me too. Well, we have seen some. And believe me,
it's not. I mean, I think, didn't Hunter Thompson make an entire career out of that?
Okay. I'm going to be quiet now.
Actually, no, it wasn't drunk. It was a combination.
We have read a book that was made on the show, and we don't speak ill of the dead. you know, every book has merit. Every single book has merit. Whether it's your first book and poorly edited and poorly written, or it's your last book that is like superb. Every book has its merits, but far be it from us. We're not critics. We talk about the writer's getting into the story and how well he pervades his story. That's what we get into. So and that's why we tell you, you know, your writing was phenomenal. We saw every place you wrote about. And that actually is a feat, because you did a great job.
Well, thank you.
So, you're welcome.
Yeah, but I'm with you on that. I mean, I'm always telling my students, you know, if you write something, you create something, it now exists in the world and it didn't before. That alone deserves a lot of, you know, praise and respect and admiration, because the reality is the vast majority of people want to write a book, want to create something,
right,
but don't. And that's not a criticism of the vast majority of the people.
Right.
It's a daunting, scary process. Yeah. But those who stick with it and do it, you know, really do deserve a lot of praise. Good, bad, otherwise. It's not an easy thing to do. And without any real immediate reward either, right? I mean, it's a big leap of faith. Yeah.
Well, like we tell everybody that comes through our company, don't give up your day job.
Yeah.
If you think you're going to cha-ching first book, we got a hot flash for you.
Yeah, that's very rare. Very rare.
Right now, we're in the middle of doing a three-book arc for Declan Finn, who is a famous, world-famous, the Dragon Award winner or runner-up.
Dragon Award finalist. He's been nominated three times, which he reminds me, because I've got one, he's got three, and it's like, okay, fine, whatever.
Richard Polinelli has one.
I have one.
Declan Finn has three.
Yep.
So where are my kudos going to go? We love you, Richard. Declan's got three.
And he's got three. I can't argue with numbers. He's got three. He's the man.
Hey, you know what? It's been great having you, Evan. Our time's up.
Okay.
And I told you it was going to go fast.
Yeah. But that's a credit.
So, don't go away after the show.
Okay.
We're gonna sit and BS for a little bit before we sign off. And Richard,
and remind everybody,
they can find you.
Obviously, you're listening this week, but in the future, if you miss a week, we have this podcast online for the audio, and we have a video version that also is online. So you can see what we're doing when we're talking.
Next week, we are doing the best of and Thanksgiving, which will be our show about the Tuscany Bay books and the writing process and publishing and editing and proofreading and formatting. And with our publicist, Mickey Mickelson, joined us. And then the following week, we have writer, let me see, who is she? Carol Mel Lucas, and she also is a comedian. She's a host. She does everything. So that'll be the week following that. And Evan, why don't you real quick tell everybody where they can find you?
I haven't updated this thing in a while, but I do have a website. You can, and if you go onto Amazon or other places and just Google my name, my books will come up. Yeah, they're all there, and it's Balkan. You'll find me.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Thank you for joining us. I know it's getting late there. Like I said, don't go away. We're going to be off the air here in just a minute. Yep. And for Sam Hassan and our engineer extraordinaire and, of course, the owner of LA Talk Radio, to my friend and partner and colleague, Mr. Richard Polinelli, Bobby Jean Bell, who couldn't be here, Russ Avison, who will be returning the third week in December, and, of course, the bookie, without whom we could not have this show. That would be my wife, Jerry. Thank you, Jerry, and myself. We are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.